So our final presenter is Dr. Clarissa Simon, who recently earned her doctorate in human development and social policy. Yes, give her a hand. From Northwestern University, after having already earned an MPH in epidemiology from the University of Michigan. Her research interests include the social endocrinology of new parents, including how parenting and relationship contexts are associated with maternal and paternal physiology. Please welcome Dr. Simon.
And I actually finished 3 weeks ago so that I could be introduced as doctor. So just in time for lunch, I'm going to be talking about salivary cortisol in new mothers and fathers. I have no relationship. So we've all seen this slide before. I just wanted to show everyone how the salivary cortisol fits in. It's one aspect of maternal allostatic load that we're looking at. And although we have collections at 6 months and 12 months and 24 months, as well as second and third trimester and postpartum for the subsequent child, I'm going to actually be discussing the six-month results. In particular, I'm going to be talking about the salivary cortisol. At the Lake County site, which is just north of Chicago, we also have paternal biomarkers, so I'll be discussing the maternal and the paternal salivary cortisol results. So why do we need saliva? Obviously, we have a ton of stress and resilience measures, so I'm going to just talk a little bit about why these measures are so unique and interesting for this study. So in most studies of postpartum adjustment, there's a lot of focus on either parent adjustment or child developmental outcomes, and there's usually an exclusive focus on psychosocial outcomes. In addition, usually we talk about maternal and child health, but what I'm going to be discussing is actually talking about paternal as well. One understudied pathway towards understanding postpartum biology, the postpartum adjustment, postpartum stress and resilience, is postpartum biology. Looking at 6 months postpartum, we're trying to understand the non-immediate postpartum period. We want to understand both maternal and paternal postpartum biology. And we are also looking at links between mothers and fathers in the same family in the same way that we're looking at stress links, stress and resilience factors between mothers and fathers. So in the study that I'm going to be, well, I should say in this aspect of this much larger overarching study, I'm going to be giving equal inclusion to maternal and paternal biology, not just me, but everyone involved in the study. I'm looking at mid-year during the first postpartum year, and relating these hormones to relationship and parenting factors. So one way we do this is to look at the stress-sensitive hormone cortisol to better understand how everyday stressors get under the skin. So we have a lot of self-report measures, but the best way to really understand what's going on physiologically is to look at biology and how these levels of hormones are related to later health and developmental outcomes. And I also like fun pictures. In particular, we want to look at how new parent everyday stressors and experiences get under the skin, and in particular behavioral choices such as breastfeeding, and also looking at sleep and relationship quality factors. So cortisol is a stress hormone, and it's responsive to social experiences and also to cognitive appraisals of those social experiences. It has significant implications for functioning. So adequate basal levels, I'll go into more detail about that. That's what we're looking at here, which is the diurnal rhythm across the day in cortisol, as well as another aspect of cortisol reactivity, which is the increase due to stresses across the day or unusual stressors. These levels are actually essential for health and daily functioning. We often think of cortisol as being and stress as being bad, but we actually need a certain basal rhythm, and we want to have a certain amount of reactivity for functioning. Alterations in cortisol due to chronic stress may be associated with later poor health. And also, cortisol is very reliably and very unobtrusively measured in saliva, and I'll discuss that in more detail. In terms of motherhood, I love this picture. during pregnancy, cortisol increases across across pregnancy, throughout pregnancy, with sharp declines upon childbirth, and there's usually a resumption of pre-pregnancy levels by about 12 weeks postpartum. Relatively higher levels of cortisol are associated with increased maternal responsiveness to infants, in particular to crying infants, in human studies, and with increased vigilance in a host of animal studies as well. So the prior studies seem to suggest that higher levels are actually beneficial for new mothers in caring for their babies. Overall, across the five sites, collected from mothers at 6 months postpartum. The return rates were about 67%, with over 1,000 mothers returning their kits. Rates did differ by race and ethnicity, with the white mothers being more likely to return their kits compared to black and Hispanic mothers. And they differed by poverty level, with the highest return rates being in the highest income group. Lake County, which is, again, just north of Chicago, and although we call it a suburban area, it's actually fairly diverse. So this is just a graphic of where it's located. And we had mother and father biomarkers available at 6 months postpartum with a slightly higher return rate, closer to 70%, but also, interestingly, almost an identical return rate for mothers and fathers. When we analyzed the data, we excluded for the following criteria: pregnancy, because as I discussed, we have these increases for pregnant mothers, corticosteroid use, shift work, which changes the diurnal rhythm, and a missing time and date information that'll be clearer why we excluded for that later. The sample size here that I'm going to discuss for the mothers was 195, but then for the mother-father group, I looked at pairs, so mothers and fathers in the same family, and so that sample size is 90. So salivary sampling, all the sampling was done at home during the interview. The participant received a salivary kit, and in that kit were vials and straws that the participant spit through and gave small quantities of saliva. They wrote down the time and date. We call this passive drool because they really do just spit right through a tube. It sounds not terribly appealing, but I am fascinated because this is what I study. So, and then they also we also collect information on diaries in the morning and evening on events of the day and mood, medication use, and things like that that might affect cortisol levels. And we have them collect upon wake-up, 30 minutes after waking, and bedtime to best capture the diurnal rhythm, and that's what I'm going to talk about next. This would be an example of a normative diurnal rhythm. The times are here, but they're really based on an individual's wake-up and bedtime, not on these. This would be fit to a particular individual based on their own wake-up and bedtimes. So the first thing I want everyone to notice is that levels of cortisol are high at wake-up. They reach a peak 30 minutes post-waking. This is called the cortisol awakening response, with the lowest levels in the evening and before bedtime. Another aspect is reactivity. So this is an increase in response to stressors. I'm going to be talking about the diurnal rhythm, but I want everyone to be aware of this other aspect of cortisol, that it is reactive to events of the day. So in this study, our main cortisol outcome that we're looking at is called the slope. So this is the diurnal decline across the day. It's the decline from wake-up to bedtime. We're looking at this because steeper slopes, so higher morning values and lower bedtime values, are associated with better health. And so this is used as one measure of allostatic load in all of our measures of allostatic load because it is associated with so many more positive health outcomes. So first we looked at cortisol rhythms by race and ethnicity. The solid lines actually show the rhythm, so you can see wake up is high, wake plus 30 is the highest, with the lowest levels at bedtime. That's what we would expect. And although I don't have a p-value on here, p-value is less than 0.05. The white mothers, that blue line, they have a steeper slope compared to the black and Latina mothers. And that's represented by that dotted line to show the slope. You can see that the steepest line is the blue line. And then this is just showing the African-American women having flatter slopes, that green line, compared to the blue line, the Caucasian women. You can see that it's steeper. But we notice that after adjusting for sleep quality, perceived stress, income, age, co-sleeping, and breastfeeding, the differences were no longer significant. Why were they no longer significant? Because of breastfeeding and co-sleeping. So we looked at those in more detail. So first, just breaking apart breastfeeding, currently breastfeeding at 6 months versus not. It was not significantly associated with cortisol slopes. So you can see the purple line is breastfeeding, the blue line is not currently breastfeeding. Once we controlled for co-sleeping, however, this purple line, currently breastfeeding, they did have a steeper slope. So they did show what we would consider more optimal cortisol rhythms because of the association with later health outcomes. And then by co-sleeping, so the purple line is actually not co-sleeping, and you can see that the mothers who did not co-sleep with their infants had steeper slopes compared to those who did not. The mothers who did not co-sleep had steeper slopes compared to the mothers who did co-sleep. Again, this is at 6 months postpartum. And this is significant after controlling for breastfeeding. So when we included sleep quality, perceived stress, income, race, and age in the model, along with co-sleeping and breastfeeding, co-sleeping was associated with flatter slopes, and breastfeeding was marginally associated with steeper slopes. So we wanted to see what this might mean. We broke the mothers down into four categories. And what we found was that the mothers who breastfed but did not co-sleep had the steepest slopes. And the co-sleeping, non-breastfeeding mothers had the flattest slopes. Those who either did neither or both were in the middle. I'll make that a little bit more clear. So these two categories in the middle are the ones that I'm looking at. That was the biggest difference. So here, the purple line is those who are breastfeeding, not co-sleeping. They have steeper slopes compared to the mothers who were blue line, co-sleeping but not breastfeeding, who had the flattest slopes. And this was still significant after adjustments. So what do we find for maternal cortisol? First, there's flatter slopes for African-American women compared to our other groups. There's a steeper slope for breastfeeding, non-co-sleeping women. We already know that breastfeeding is a physiologic stress reducer, so that makes sense. The co-sleeping finding might seem a little bit unusual because we know that co-sleeping actually encourages breastfeeding in the immediate postpartum. But again, this is 6 months postpartum. At that time, infants have mature circadian rhythms. They're presumably sleeping through the night. So the mothers who co-sleep, they might actually have interrupted sleep from co-sleeping with their babies. So this shows a possible pathway towards more ideal physiologic stress patterns for women. Now moving to paternal cortisol. Even less is known about postpartum paternal biology than maternal biology. We know male physiology changes with fatherhood. Everyone here is testosterone. We all know I think most people in the audience are probably familiar with all this new research that's coming out showing that testosterone decreases in new fathers. And we want to know, could cortisol provide insights into father physiology and his role in the family? So sort of carrying through on what Bowen was talking about, do fathers collect samples on the same day as their partners? 50% of them do, which suggests that mother-father participation biomarker collection is linked in the same way that overall participation is linked. So 98% of fathers who participate, who send in their salivary kits, also have corresponding maternal kits. And white fathers, older fathers, fathers who report better relationships are more likely to send in their kits, again, similar to overall participation rates. We find that slopes are flatter for fathers. So fathers here are blue, mothers are kind of that purple pink. But it's based on morning levels. The bedtime levels are actually very similar. And again, these are paired samples. So these are mothers and fathers in the same family. And this difference is still significant after controls. So what can we say about gender differences in cortisol? There's a lot of prior animal studies showing that there are higher levels of glucocorticoids in females compared to males. In human studies, there's evidence for a higher female cortisol response to stress, so that gets into reactivity. But there's much less known about diurnal rhythm differences by gender. And they may be, in this group, related to levels of postpartum hormones. In men, testosterone, women, estrogen, we actually have those hormones. We're looking at those now. The findings that are based on morning differences alone, this also could be a matter of compliance. Mothers could be actually collecting when they wake up, and that could be contributing to the differences. Mothers could have increased demands of the day, so cortisol is responsive to anticipated demands. They might have more demands than fathers. And it might get into objective sleep quality. We have measures of subjective sleep quality, but none with objective measures of actual sleep quality, just what they report. So in a prior study, men have reduced cortisol responses under stress when they receive partner supports. Now we're looking at whether or not relationship quality could matter here. And so what we can say is that partner cortisol is responsive to relationship quality. So we want to see that in terms of diurnal rhythms. Our research question here is, beyond demographic and parenting factors, can the intimate relationship between mother and father also get under the skin? We find that for mothers, relationship quality does not matter for cortisol rhythms, and it does not matter after controls. For fathers, however, similar to the reactivity studies, the fathers here in the green have steeper slopes. So if fathers who are in better relationships have more optimal stress rhythms, they have steeper slopes. And that's still significant after appropriate controls. So what can we conclude? Well, stress hormones here do differ by gender and by race and ethnicity. Fathers have flatter slopes based on lower morning levels. And the differences by race and ethnicity might be partly attributable to differences in parenting choices, particularly with breastfeeding and co-sleeping. We can also say that fathers and mothers are physiologically responsive to different social and behavioral factors. So for mothers, breastfeeding and co-sleeping is associated with maternal cortisol profiles. For fathers, relationship quality is. In terms of implications, parenting choices and relationship quality may ascribe certain physiologic benefits for parents, which could be associated with better health outcomes for babies and for parents and for the relationship quality. So in terms of the mother-father relationship, it is an important context for the study of stress physiology. And right now we're currently linking cortisol patterns to later birth outcomes and to future maternal and paternal health outcomes. And thank you very much.